Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll deal with a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Steve Clemens, who's a publisher of the popular political blog, thewashingtonnote.com. He is currently a senior fellow at the New America Foundation, and he's been very active in opposing the nomination of John Bolton to become ambassador to the United Nations. And of course, John Bolton's nomination was stalled, came out of committee without a recommendation, and it was put into the background because of the threat to end the filibuster of judicial nominations. But after a compromise was reached, Senator Frist managed to slip it onto the floor where it was essentially filibustered, and it won't come up till probably next week sometime, although there's an expectation at the end of the day that he will be approved, subject to this new paperwork that the Democrats are demanding. We'll also speak with Kate Seeley, who's an NPR Middle East reporter. She also was featured in a PBS Frontline piece on Lebanon, the political earthquake in Lebanon, and the tensions in neighboring Syria, where there's an expectation that the regime of Hafez al-Assad or his son, Bashar al-Assad, is in trouble, perhaps about to disintegrate. So we'll be talking to her both about the elections today in Lebanon, the first free elections in 30 years, although still operating under the old rules. So we'll look into the status of people power in Lebanon, what might be happening today in the elections, and what is happening inside of Syria. And we'll also talk with David Phillips, who is a former senior advisor to the State Department. He worked on the group that prior to the Iraq war looked into post-war plans to rebuild Iraq. And, of course, all these plans were orphaned by Secretary of Defense and his people, Rumsfeld and Feith and Wolfowitz, etc. And it led directly to the chaos that we see today as the portent of a civil war becomes more and more apparent. And he is the author of a new book, Losing Iraq, Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco, where he, as I mentioned, had a was sitting in the catbird seat there. So we'll get an inside story onto how Iraq was screwed up so incredibly badly. I'm speaking with Steve Clemens, who is the publisher of the popular political blog, WashingtonNote.com. He is currently a senior fellow at the New American Foundation, and he's been active in opposing the nomination of John Bolton to become ambassador to the United Nations. And as it stands, Steve, looks like Bolton's nomination will come up probably next week, and there's an expectation that he will squeak in. But there is some new paperwork that the Democrats are demanding. But I guess in the run-up to this, it seems to me that the Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist lost control of the Senate on two occasions, and I guess it's been a bad week for him.
I think it's been a terrible week for Bill Frist. I'm less certain than you are, and many other skeptics, that the Bolton nomination can be expected to go through at all. We have a real standstill between the White House and those senators who blocked movement forward, not on paperwork, but on very, very important National Security Agency intercepts and other emails and information which the State Department and the White House have regularly objected to giving to the senators. You know, this is not privileged information or information blocked by executive privilege. It's, you know, the White House has made an arbitrary decision not to provide documentation to the Senate. And that's what that filibuster was about. And so until the White House concedes, which they've now said they won't, then the Bolton nomination will be indefinitely in limbo. So I guess I'm much more confident than others that the Bolton nomination is actually, you know, stuck in a very serious rut right now.
Well, the I guess paperwork is an inadequate term for it, but this was addressed in the Senate by Senator Rockefeller, who's the ranking chair of the Select Intelligence Committee, And he and Pat Roberts, the chair, were both showed these intercepts. Apparently, they in the secure environment that they have there.
Right.
And it's unusual to order these intercepts, and Bolton did. He ordered an unusual number of them, and they it seems like they were targeting American citizens, unquestionably, because that's why they're so highly classified, and it's an unusual practice
in
the first place.
Yeah, there were intercepts that essentially we now know focused on two times in history. We don't know what the specific incidents were, but we understand that there's a possibility that they dealt either with concerns over Syria, concerns over Iraq, or North Korea. And what Bolton was requesting from the NSA, in addition to these intercepts, was the names of U.S. officials that had been scrubbed out of the intercepts. And what Senator Rockefeller noted in his very impressive roster of concerns about Bolton is that Bolton himself violated the protocols of intelligence by actually, you know, congratulating one of his people for something that he knew they had done after having read about it in these intercepts. But it's very important to note that what Pat Roberts and Jay Rockefeller got was not what Senator Biden and Senator Lugar requested. They requested the roster of names, they requested the intercepts, and they've requested other information in addition, which was never provided. I think it's somewhat amazing that the White House actually defied Senator Lugar, the Republican chairman of the committee. The Senate Intelligence Committee has no jurisdiction over the Bolton nomination. And so what John Negroponte, currently our Director of National Intelligence, did is he pulled off a bureaucratic scuffle where he said he's not going to comply with requests from the Foreign Relations Committee, and he's going to make one committee try to get information out of another. But they never provided the essential documentation that was requested by the senators, even to the Intelligence Committee. So there's a lot of misreporting, unfortunately, out there about that. But that's what that filibuster was about, and it's why people like Joe Lieberman, who have, you know, been frankly on the fence on this issue of Bolton.
Well, he's one of the 14. I mean,
yeah, he supported us in blocking this from going forward. It was really remarkable. Now John McCain, who's trying to broker another deal while he supported those to bring this vote to cloture the other day, is now saying that the Democrats and others who have a very important case, that they deserve getting this documentation. So it's very much in play, and so the White House has to concede those materials. And so far, Scott McClellan and Condi Rice have indicated that they are not going to. That means the Bolton nomination will die or will hang on the vine and wither until something breaks. And unfortunately, they're not going to take another vote on exactly the same thing until the White House, you know, concedes something.
Well, I think, isn't there a possibility that this also indicates that Bolton, and I don't know who was tasking him to do this or whether he's on his own reconnaissance here, but it looks as if that he was sort of spying on his boss, Secretary of State Colin Powell.
Yeah, and if not Powell, then at least Armitage. I mean, there's some speculation that Richard Armitage went to extraordinary lengths to keep Bolton contained. And what Bolton seems to have done throughout not only these intercepts, but throughout the pattern of, remember, it's not just the intercepts. We have lots more.
Right.
It's quite transparent, is that he was constantly trying to end run those who were trying to contain him, both in terms of intelligence, spying on what they were saying about him, and trying to find out details of operations and diplomatic efforts that Powell had initiated, but that Bolton had been blocked from. So you had essentially a kind of civil war going on inside the State Department over who was going to conduct policy, what that policy was going to be. And while this is an overstatement, it's very clear that Vice President Cheney did support what John Bolton was doing, but was doing it in such a way to defy Powell. And that kind of misbehavior is something that's given a lot of senators, and particularly George Voinovich and John Thune, and frankly, there are about a half dozen other moderate Republicans who I think are rethinking their position on Bolton today.
But knowing how the NSA is constrained by the law not to spy on U.S. citizens,
that's right,
and how super secretive they are, and how little distribution there is of their product, only usually to the president. You have to assume that it was Dick Cheney who enabled Bolton to put these requests into the NSA.
Well, I wouldn't say it was just Dick Cheney. I mean, we had a...
Well, where does he get his authority? He's an undersecretary for arms control and nonproliferation, isn't he?
Undersecretaries of state, particularly, remember, he had an active CIA senior staff person acting as his chief of staff in the State Department, Fred Flights. The two of them together with their network became incredibly dangerous in my view. It's what allowed so much of cherry picking of intelligence, because Flights had his own CIA connections to bring in intelligence that was not yet packaged, that could compete both with official CIA assessments as well as official State Department intelligence and research assessments. But the issue is that Bolton, within this matrix, did have certain authorities within the undersecretary role that he had. What is unusual is that almost no one at that level requests such intercepts. So he did request these of the NSA, this information. They were approved. But now the question is, did he mismanage and misuse the information that he got? And Rockefeller is saying, yes, he did, at least in one occasion. And Rockefeller only has the tip of the iceberg, because there's been no serious investigation of this. So we already can tell transparently that Bolton violated lots of rules when it comes to intelligence. But it is exactly what you're pointing to, not just that Cheney empowered him, because I think that oversimplifies the case. I think that Flights and Bolton together, at war with certain intelligence operations in our government, with backing from the vice president's office, was able to create a kind of rogue division of sorts within the government. And so Cheney certainly was part of that power package, but Bolton had other pieces of the government actually under his sway as well.
And, of course, Bolton you can trace him back to the famous vote count in Florida, the count that was stopped by what was described as the Gucci Revolt, where a bunch of Republican activists stormed the courthouse to stop the counting of the votes
right.
in 2000.
I'm with Bush Cheney, and I'm
right.
here to stop the vote.
Right, and he was their leader.
Yeah.
So another, and then apparently he was incredibly unpopular with Powell and company, He was lobbying for the number two job at State, and he didn't get that. And apparently, it's been pretty clear that Cheney has been his patron all along.
That's absolutely right. I mean, I think it explains. I mean, at any normal time in American history, after everything we knew about Bolton, after the bizarre circumstances in which his nomination had come out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, gone to the floor, these passionate positions on both sides of the aisle against him, you'd see the White House retract this nomination and find some other desk job for John Bolton to do elsewhere, perhaps in Cheney's office. But the White House has been tenaciously committed to Bolton and willing to run roughshod even over the sensibilities of its own moderate wing of its party, because Bolton is one of these blind loyalists, and he performed in Florida for them, stopping the vote count. And my only, explanation for this is that Bolton is one of these blind loyalists, someone who's willing to sort of go to fanatical, lengths for the boss, and I think way beyond what's principle or democratic or that fits within our form of civil society. And if they undo their support for Bolton, then it sends a shockwave through their other kind of league of blind loyalists.
Well, isn't it reasonable to assume, Steve Clemens, that we have a president who is pugnacious, takes no prisoners, is in your face, doubles down like you do in blackjack? Every time he has a problem, he rather than repent or retreat, he doubles down. Isn't Bolton Bush's kind of guy?
Absolutely, and that's why we're winning on this, and why I would tell your listeners and whatnot not to believe the media. The media at every point of this, the major media, have said, before we had the last committee vote, then we were down the floor, that there'd be a party line vote affirming Bolton. And at each stage, I've been writing that's simply not the case. That you need to look, we need to recalibrate, because President Bush, by overreaching and with this pugnaciousness, has now what's crumbling is that part of their moderate wing is not supporting. They're beginning, this is, when you look at stem cell, you look at the Social Security debate, you look at the debate that's begun to unfold on Bolton and other issues, the judges, you see none of this would be possible if the Republican House was in order. But it's not in order because of the president and the style that he's brought to this and attitude is offending his own ranks. And that's very good for those on the progressive side who can begin finding common cause with some of those folks in the Republican middle. So,
well, Steve Clemens, I don't know whether you saw Senator Voinovich's speech on the Senate floor.
Absolutely.
And it was extremely emotional. He cracked up a few times. It was obviously very heartfelt. And here's a man who's a Republican who's saying, you know, he's actually making a patriotic appeal. He's talking about his grandchildren, his children, the kind of world that they're going to live in. He's saying America's isolated in the world. I guess by implication, this administration has done it. But I'm adding that the long and the short of it was he was saying, look, we need friends. We're out there alone. And the only way we're going to get through this this war on terror, et cetera, is to have friends and cooperation in the world. And this guy is the worst possible guy he could have. And he was begging his colleagues. I guess he's begging them not to be, clones of the White House. And I guess that's my real question to you, Steve, is what's going on here? You've got people like Senator Pat Roberts, who's just a total toady for the White House. And so is Hatch. I mean, look what they did with the Rob Silverman report,
right,
where they went out of their way to trash Ambassador Wilson and his wife, the CIA officer that they outed, just in sleazy character assassination, which is, you know, almost irrational. And the fact that Rockefeller had to go up there, and of course Roberts immediately tried to repudiate what Rockefeller did,
right,
in spite of all this stupid, Senate language about I respectfully disagree with my learned colleague, you could feel the venom and anger that's there. So again, what's going on here? I mean, the Senate is a separate body. This is a part of the separation of powers. This is what the Founding Fathers devised. Why are these guys subjugating their role and their dignity and in fact their manhood to be toadies and water carriers for this president?
I think it's very disgusting and very harmful to American democracy that some of the people you mentioned are subordinating themselves to such degree to the White House. As it really is, I know this will sound trite to some people, it's really about not letting a kind of monarchial-like situation take over our government. You know, people have talked about keep saying the president deserves his team. It's the constitutional duty of the United States Senate to inform the president when he makes a bad decision on someone, and that's what he's done on John Bolton. That is why the process is in place, because the president is not infallible, and the president does not have all powers of government. But what's begun to come undone, and what this has really been about, is a 5-6 year honeymoon period for George Bush, slowly, hopefully more quickly now, coming to an end, because they have actually tried to take Congress as a whole. It's been very effective until Tom DeLay began stumbling and others. They had essentially subordinated the U.S. Congress to the whim of the White House. And so why are they playing that toady role? Because they know that challenging the White House under these circumstances means that they will lose access, that the White House will try and find ways to punish them, shut them down, close them down. And so it takes real bravery in this political climate for George Voinovich to do what he's done, or now John Thune. And there are others. You're going to hear others, because now what happens is people smell blood, and you're going to find more and more strength beginning to build in the center. Finally, it's taken a long time. But I think that people see, when you look at the many battles the White House is all of a sudden losing on every front, the calculus is changing, and now people are going to begin returning to, I think, more the... It's not going to solve the Pat Roberts problem, and you're absolutely right. He's acting like a sycophantic spear carrier for George Bush. And I do think you're going to begin seeing a reversal of that now, because I think that they're betraying their constituents, and I think they're betraying the citizens of this country.
Yeah, it's as though Karl Rove runs a Senate agenda, or at least the Republican Senate agenda.
And it's
worth noting that Senator Lugar, who's highly respected on foreign affairs, he privately asked the White House not to send Bolton's nomination over.
Yeah, Dick Lugar is a great man. His sensibilities in foreign policy are fair-minded, and he believes in American engagement in the world. He's not a heavy-handed guy, but I've been disappointed because he's given the White House the benefit of the doubt more often than he should and way more often than it deserves. And it was his requests to the White House that are being defied, and he's not the one protecting or defending his own interests in this case. So while I have great respect for Senator Lugar, he's a very interesting benchmark for how nasty. You know, I've told people in this Bolton fight that if we're going to lose, if Bolton ends up in the UN, then at least we're going to lose by drawing the White House in to show how grotesque, how far they're willing to go beyond any limits of rationality to run roughshod over their own Republican moderates, because that in the end means that they haven't won at all. They've sent someone who's highly damaged to the United Nations, who's going to be constrained, that the moment Bolton oversteps a line, people will be leaking to me and others everything that they're doing. And in the process, they've spent enormous political capital to try to make a very inappropriate nomination go forward. So from my viewpoint, it's very, very hard for those of us who've opposed Bolton to lose at all, whether he goes to the UN at all or not.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles today.
Thank you,
Steve
Ian.
Steve Clemens, bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking then with Steve Clemens, who is the publisher of the popular political blog WashingtonNote.com, and he is currently a senior fellow at the New American Foundation, and he's been very active in opposing the nomination of John Bolton to become ambassador to the United Nations. I'm now going to Lebanon to speak with Kate Seeley, who's a reporter for National Public Radio, PBS Frontline, and BBC World. She's lived for many years in Lebanon, and she's been covering the elections there today in Lebanon, first free elections in 30 years. But it seems, Kate Seeley, that even though this is a free election and the Cedar Revolution is propelled by people power has brought this about, it seems that this election is taking place under the same old rules.
Yes, and it's going to take time to change those. I mean, Lebanon has a very complicated electoral system. An electoral law was put in place in 2000, sort of under Syrian domination. It gave certain groups more influence and more power than others, and that same electoral law is in place today in 2005. Many groups, the Christians especially, opposed that law, but it would have taken several weeks and months to renegotiate a new law, and Lebanon was under pressure from the Americans and the French to essentially hold elections on time. So the country is going ahead with elections under a somewhat flawed electoral law, and there are people who are unhappy about that, but at the same time, many people did go and vote today in Beirut, and there is a lot of excitement about the fact that these are the first elections free of Syrian domination, at least in the last couple of decades.
And the people who camped out, the young who camped out in Mada Square, how do they feel about it, given that it's the same old sort of political backroom deals, and I take it that there is some disenchantment amongst the young, that they brought about this revolution?
Yeah,
Sorry.
Yeah, there is a great deal of ambivalence. I mean, I went to the polls today. In fact, I didn't see a lot of young people. It was mainly sort of the middle-aged and the elderly. I think for a lot of them, you know, that they do feel as though they're seeing the same old faces. They're frustrated by the way politics are played in Lebanon, which is very much kind of under the table. For instance, Saad Hariri is the son of Rafiq Hariri. He and his allies have put together a list of candidates who they sort of chose, and they've swept the elections here in Beirut. And some of them actually got into power uncontested because nobody would run against them. And so people will have seats in parliament without ever having had someone cast a vote for them. The young are also frustrated because many of them support General Aoun, who was an exiled general who left Lebanon in 89. He just came back a few weeks ago, and he was sort of part of the opposition in exile, but once he returned, he couldn't form alliances with the other opposition, the people like the Hariri group and Jumblat, the big Druze leader. There was sort of competition between them, so he's been left out in the cold here in Beirut. He had no candidates running, and a lot of young people I spoke to today were very unhappy about that, because they like Aoun, they want to vote for his people, but they're not represented in Beirut.
So you're talking about the sort of the political sort of legitimization of the old sectarian kind of warlord structures.
Well, you know, everyone realizes here that that warlord structure has to change. But, you know, this is the first time that Lebanon is holding elections free of sort of a Syrian domination that was very happy to keep that warlord structure in place. So I think there's a sense here that, you know, these are the first elections and probably significant change is not going to take place until the next elections. That, you know, with a new electoral law and perhaps with more participation in the next elections, a lot of these old faces that have been around since the Civil War will be swept away. So, you know, legitimization of the warlord system, perhaps, but people are going into these elections very aware that they do want to change that. It's just that these elections were very rushed. I mean, they happened, you know, on the heels of the Syrian withdrawal. They happened on the heels of this huge kind of uprising that led to this unexpected withdrawal. There wasn't a lot of time to sort of change the system in order to have perhaps more free and fair elections than perhaps are taking place.
Well, of course, the question that's asked a lot and alluded to is the idea that Syria moved in there to end the civil war and to bring about a stability, and that appears to have worked. And the assumption is that now that they've gone, there's a possibility of a return to the sectarian violence that we saw. But I mean, there's no evidence of it, but there is that sort of, I guess, knee-jerk expectation, you might describe it as.
You know, I tend to think that knee-jerk expectation comes from the Western press, frankly. A lot of Lebanese, though they're a little anxious about the future, really don't think that the conditions are in place to return to a civil war. You don't have armed Palestinian militias. I mean, you do, but you don't have the PLO in place. You don't have the same kind of armed Christian militias that one had at the beginning of the civil war back in 1975. The conditions that led to the civil war no longer exist. There may be sectarian tensions, but there is no desire to go back to a civil war, especially since it was so destructive and so exhausting. So I think the Lebanese realize, okay, there are tensions, but these don't necessarily have to be unhealthy tensions. There are tensions in every political system. There are tensions in the United States, you know, between the various political parties. And we just have to work on building civil institutions, civil societies. We've got to work on moving away from this confessional political system in which everybody turns to their religious leader for support or turns to their religious leader to vote for that community rather than turning to a leader who represents all religions. So there's a realization it's going to take time to build that, to build a civil society free of sectarian or confessional tendencies, but that is the hope. And I think if people hope that, there is a possibility that with time, over the next 4 to 5 years, or over the next 10 years, that may come about. There is not a lot of fear of a return to civil war here. There are fears of tensions, there are fears of some violence, but not of a return to civil war.
And I guess, Kate Seeley, the person most responsible for binding these wounds and healing this country was the late Prime Minister who was assassinated, Rafiq Hariri.
Yes, and I think that's why, for instance, his list, his political allies have done so well in Beirut today. He died. He wasn't hugely loved while he was alive because, you know, he was a politician accused of some corruption, and the Lebanese are cynical and, you know, didn't always love Hariri. When he died, people realized at least he wasn't confessional. At least he hadn't been a warlord. At least he didn't have blood on his hands. At least he gave scholarships equally to Christians and Muslims. At least he built a downtown Beirut for all the Lebanese. So they're turning to his son, who is now sort of following in his footsteps, is Saad Hariri. I'm, in fact, at the Hariri home tonight, and everybody's cheering their victory. And they've turned to his allies, and they've just elected them in this electoral sweep in Beirut. And the hope is that this list of relatively moderate, educated, professional Lebanese will lead Lebanon along the same path that Rafiq Hariri was leading Lebanon, which was toward a more international, open Lebanon, open to foreign investment and tourism.
Kate Seeley, the report that you did recently that was shown here on Frontline World about the political earthquake in Lebanon and the situation in Syria, the report showed a meeting that took place with Bashar al-Assad and Hariri shortly before Hariri was assassinated, where it appeared that that Assad dressed Hariri down, because I guess there was an expectation that Hariri was going to side with the opposition against the Syrians. What do we make of that in terms of what happened later?
Well, I mean, essentially, that was the break between Hariri and Syria. Hariri had always been sort of a reluctant ally of Syria's, but he realized that if he was going to rebuild Lebanon when he came into power in the 90s, that he had to do that in conjunction with the Syrians. So he always worked with the Syrians, but at the same time, his relations weren't extremely close. The Syrians didn't always trust him. And as the Syrian domination over Lebanon heightened and increased in 2001, 2002, 2003, actually with the rise of Bashar al-Assad to power, I think Hariri became more and more disillusioned. And so by the time that there was this need to change, the presidential term had come to its end, and it was time to elect a new president, which the Syrians decided they didn't want to do. They wanted to keep the old president, their ally, in power. So by the time Hariri went to Damascus to be told by Damascus, you must extend this president's term limit against the Constitution, Hariri did so reluctantly. And he did so knowing that it was probably not in the best interest of Lebanon. And he did so probably thinking that it was about time Syria be pressured to leave. So he went to Syria. The Syrians treated him very roughly, according to the stories that he told to his allies back in Lebanon. Bashar al-Assad told him in a 10-minute meeting, Lahoud is my man in Lebanon, and if you do not extend his term limit, I will break Lebanon over your head. So Hariri returned to Beirut, according to his story, told to his colleagues who passed this on to the press, returned to Beirut, a very somewhat shaken man, and proceeded to do exactly what the Syrians told him to do, which was to extend Lahoud's term, to get Parliament to extend Lahoud's term. And he was so disgusted by this process, he resigned. And that's when he turned toward the opposition. And it's believed that turn toward the opposition, this sort of full turn toward the opposition, was an enormous threat to Damascus.
But it's sort of strange and ironic, Kate Seeley, that the apologists for the Syrian regime, who appeared in your Frontline piece, basically say, well, how could we have been so stupid as to have assassinated Hariri? Look what happened. But on the other hand, all the evidence points to the fact that that's what did happen.
All I can say, Ian, is that there is no evidence. Nobody knows.
Right.
But who really did this? The Syrians have a good point. I mean, this doesn't seem to be in their interest, does it, to,
right.
be behind an assassination that would lead to them being kicked out. But people here will say the Syrians underestimate the Lebanese. They've always held the Lebanese in contempt. The Lebanese believe the Syrians have been behind a series of political assassinations in the past that they have gotten away with. And the feeling here in Lebanon is that the Syrians thought they could get away with yet another political assassination, that there would not be an uproar. Of course, the miscalculation was that Hariri was not, Kamal Jumblatt. I'm just referencing some other Lebanese politicians who were assassinated, presumably by the Syrians, and they got away with that. But Hariri was not these other politicians. He was well-known on the international scene, and the Americans already had it out for the Syrians, and Hariri was a close ally of Jacques Chirac, also an ally of the Syrians. But, once Chirac's ally Hariri was killed, Chirac turned against the Syrians and really pushed for this, Resolution 1559 to get the Syrians out. So who knows who's behind this? But if the Syrians were, in fact, behind it, it was a big miscalculation.
For which they've paid, obviously. But let me get a sense of your feeling inside the country from your report. For example, you went up to the border there where the U.S. military is right up against the Syrian border, across the border in Iraq. And an old family friend of yours, your father was a diplomat there, who's kind of an eminence gris in Syrian politics, was describing the mood inside the Syrian power elite of being besieged and beleaguered and getting pressure from Turkey, from all sides, Turkey, Iraq, American-occupied Iraq, and from Lebanon. So give us a sense there have been talk about the possibility of the Assads and the Alawites losing power. So where give me a feeling for what your reading was. I mean, it came through in the frontline piece.
Well, I think, you know, the Syrians in power are deeply worried and concerned. They have never been in America's crosshairs as much as they are today. They have American troops on their border, which they see as a signal to them that they could possibly be next. And they're dealing with an American administration that will not negotiate with them. And the Syrians are of the thought that if you give something, you get something in return. And it appears that insurgents and money and all sorts of things are crossing the Syrian border into Iraq. The Syrians, it appears, are doing something to stop them. There are sand berms. There are reports of insurgents being arrested, and this is being reported by human rights activists who are critical of the government, who are getting calls from insurgents in prison saying, you know, get us out. So they're doing something, but they're not doing all that they could. They could do much more, but they're reluctant to because they want guarantees from the U.S. that Syria won't be next. Syria won't be invaded by the U.S. or won't be attacked by the U.S. They want guarantees that the U.S. will start negotiations with Israel over the occupied Syrian Golan Heights. So the Syrians want things in return, but the Bush administration doesn't appear ready to negotiate, and the Syrians don't seem to be willing to just sort of surrender. As a result, they're facing tremendous pressure, which they're aware of. I mean, Bashar al-Assad has said in many interviews, I expect to be attacked by the Americans. They expect a physical invasion. They are expecting the worst, and you know, there is, I think, deep fear and concern, and there's a lack of vision and a lack of leadership. Bashar has not consolidated his power, apparently. He doesn't appear to be a very strong leader. He's young. He's not, it appears, not totally in control. So I think, you know, Syria needs to also redesign its foreign policy vis-a-vis the U.S., but it seems unable to right now. So you've got two countries without particularly good foreign policy, and who knows what the results will be. But the Syrians are, in fact, expecting the worst.
But also, isn't it true?
Let me just add that this American, operation along the Syrian border just 3 weeks ago, Operation Matador, many Syrians believed it was very much aimed at them. It was an operation that was carried out right along the Syrian border. There were shells that landed in Syria from the Iraqi side. Syrians saw this as yet another sign that the Americans are breathing down their neck.
I was going to say, Kate Seeley, that also Bashar al-Assad feels beleaguered and under pressure from the United States and feeling encircled as he is, within the country there's also deep political fissures, aren't there, with 25% plus of the country unemployed, mostly young. And there appears to be two sort of strains of opposition. There's the Baathists, reformers, if you will, who believe that the system can be reformed, and then there's the dissidents who spent time in prison, who are bitter and perhaps would tend towards more violent revolution. And there is, I don't know how much the sectarian issues are important as the political ones, but the Alawite minority of about 15% dominate the Sunni majority.
Right.
And there's a history going back to the massacre at Hama of the Muslim Brotherhood in that country. So walk us through that, if you would.
Well, I think, you know, you've got a lot of opposition to the regime in Syria. Obviously, you've got Sunni opposition, the Muslim Brotherhood opposition. You have intellectuals who are opposed to this regime that seems unable to reform itself, despite having promised reform 5 years ago when Bashar came to power. So there's an enormous desire for change. And if you go and speak to the most, outspoken dissidents, they'll say, you know, we want this regime to change. But they make it very clear they want it to happen internally. They don't want to happen through external forces. They don't want there to be, an American invasion or so much American pressure that, in a sense, the regime, implodes. I think they would like sort of, gradual, not too gradual of a change, but they want more gradual change because there is fear. There is fear of Syria becoming another Iraq. There are some similar conditions on the ground. It is a sectarian country like Iraq. You do have, an angry majority, sort of the inverse of Iraq, an angry majority that might, well, actually, no, it's the same, that would turn against this minority that ruled it. You've got other sects. You've got Kurds. So Syria could become a mirror of Iraq if it's not handled carefully. So I think reformists realize that. Hence, they're not really in favor of, let's say, the Iraq model of overthrowing the regime. They want change to happen, but to happen a little more, perhaps a little more calmly or stably, if that's possible. You know, it's one of those big questions: how will it happen? But the one I think shared feeling I got from many Syrians opposed to the regime is that we don't want it to happen Iraq fashion. We want to do it our own way. What that means, who knows? Who knows? But they just don't want the Americans so overtly involved. And there is fear of what will come next. I mean, because you've got many, many secularists who want change, but they don't want the Muslim Brotherhood to come into power. And the Muslim Brotherhood are among the most organized of all the Syrians. I mean, they are in exile, but they've got many, many supporters inside Syria. And if the Alawite regime fell, presumably they would be in a position to organize faster than any of those sort of secular parties, which aren't terribly organized. So they have an advantage, the Sunni Muslim Brotherhood, over these other secular parties. And many people don't want to return, I don't think they would want that to replace this Alawite regime that potentially could reform, but potentially, and that's the big question, will it reform? It keeps promising to reform, and yet it hasn't. There's a big Baath Party conference coming up in just next week, and everybody was telling me just a month ago, this is the big turning point in Syria. They're going to open up, they're going to allow for more political parties, they're going to change the name of the Baath Party, call it the Liberal Party. But Bashar al-Assad has recently been warning not to expect too much from that conference. So it's hard to say where Syria is headed right now, frankly.
Well, Kate Seeley, I thank you very much for joining us and filling us in both on the elections today in Lebanon and the situation in Syria. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Kate Seeley, who's a reporter for National Public Radio in the Middle East. She's in Beirut at the moment, and she also works for PBS Frontline, where she had a recent piece on the political earthquake in Lebanon and the tenuous political situation in neighboring Syria. She also works for BBC World, and she's lived in Lebanon for many years. I'm now speaking with David Phillips, who is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a former senior advisor to the State Department, where he worked on a team that was tasked to prepare for the victory in Iraq and the reconstruction that would follow a certain U.S. Military victory. And he's written a book about that experience, Losing Iraq, Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. So I guess, David, the title of your book sort of it doesn't pull any punches there. But let me go back a little bit in context, if I can. Last week, I spoke with Gary Schroen, who's a CIA officer who was first into Afghanistan after 9/11 to organize the successful war against the Taliban. And we were talking about the bureaucratic war that went on in Washington concurrent with the actual boots on the ground. And what happened there was that on September the 13th, 2 days after the 9/11, there was a meeting, the war cabinet met. And at that war cabinet, both Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, instead of talking about going after the Taliban in Afghanistan, talked about invading Iraq. However, the long and the short of it is that the Pentagon didn't really have a war plan. They were averse to going into Afghanistan. It's, after all, the graveyard of empires. And the CIA were ready, and they went in, and it was successful. And George Tenet became very popular at the White House. And conversely, Rumsfeld was unhappy. And so he was determined, when he did Iraq, that he would cut everybody out. Now, is there any? In other words, he'd marginalize the CIA and the State Department, and not go through what he went through with Afghanistan. So give me a sense of that, if I'm correct in laying the sort of bureaucratic landscape out there.
I didn't hear your interview with Gary Schoen, so I can't comment upon it.
Right.
But there were different factions within the government that were involved in a very active debate about what to do with Iraq. I would characterize Vice President Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld as in the hegemonist camp. The world is full of evildoers. We better kill them before they kill us. There's a second tier around them of neoconservatives who thought that when America uses its military might, we should be driven by an ideology to transform countries around the world into model liberal democracies that are friendly to U.S. interests. And then a third camp in the State Department around Colin Powell that I describe as pragmatic internationalists who believe that when you exercise American military power, you should do that with international sanction and based on international law. The interagency process between these three camps was extremely bitter during the run-up to the war in Iraq, but then that problem was resolved on January 21, 2003, when President Bush gave to the Secretary of Defense the lead role in post-war civilian administration. From that point forward, the office of the Secretary of Defense was calling the shots and driven by this ideology and this notion of transforming the American military, they rushed to war without a plan to win the peace.
So all the work that you did was essentially orphaned? You and your team did?
The work was called the Future of Iraq Project. It was an interagency exercise over a couple of years that involved 17 federal agencies, hundreds of Iraqis, produced thousands of pages of recommendations at the cost of millions of dollars to U.S. taxpayers. There was no silver bullet in there that would have made an extremely hard job in Iraq easy, but because it wasn't ideologically compatible with the Pentagon's view of the Middle East, it was ignored and undermined.
But it's hard to understand how an ideological view could be so counterintuitive. I mean, what's the point of a quick victory followed by a slow defeat?
There was a real conviction among U.S. policymakers that the U.S. military would be in and out of Iraq in 90 days, that the total reconstruction bill would be $1.3 billion. There are U.S. officials that are on record in congressional testimony stating such. They bought a line of goods from Iraqi exiles who said they could just decapitate the Ba'ath leadership and turn Iraq into a liberal democracy, which would be a launch point for going after Ba'athists in Syria, mullahs in Iran, and transforming the Middle East into a safe space for U.S. security and energy interests.
And, David Phillips, is this a case of your side not having advocates? Because even just on this program alone, prior to the war, I spoke to the handful of people that I could get access to who knew about Iraq, people like Ambassador Joe Wilson, Graham Fuller, and others. And they all predicted that it would be a quick victory followed by a slow defeat. And, of course, if you go back to the history of the British occupation, that's pretty chilling as well. So given the fact that, in effect, your side was right, did you fail to get any traction with the truth because you didn't have a strong enough advocate?
Well, in the interagency process, and specifically the principals group, which are the key national security advisors to the president, the method of work is to debate your respective points of view and then present options to the president. For the first time in the history of the United States, the vice president currently sits on the principals committee. And with a weak national security advisor, Dr. Rice, she allowed the playing field to be tilted towards Cheney and Rumsfeld. Those who believe in good government, and I would count Mr. Powell in that category, make their best case in the principals committee, and then when the president executes a decision, it's the responsibility of U.S. officials to carry that forward, whether they agree or not. The Secretary of State didn't use the same kinds of tactics that we saw among Pentagon officials. he accepted his defeat in the interagency debate. When decisions went against the Pentagon, they kept fighting and did everything they could to undermine even the president's directives.
So I guess there's some truth to what Henry Kissinger once said, that he had never met a more skilled bureaucratic infighter than Donald Rumsfeld.
Well, Mr. Rumsfeld is a skilled bureaucratic insider, there's no doubt. But it's important that any political appointee act in the U.S. national interest. And going to war under false pretenses and having no plan to win the peace is not in the interest of the United States, the Iraqi people, or the broader freedom strategy that President Bush has articulated. It's remarkable to me that there's been no accountability, a sort of conspiracy of silence, where officials who were intimately involved in the Iraq policy have been promoted instead of reprimanded or dismissed.
And it's worth noting that one of the more experienced voices in terms of Colin Powell did, according to the Bob Woodward book, at least tell President Bush, I believe he referred to the pottery barn analogy of geopolitics, that if you break it, you own it. But Brent Scowcroft had gone public prior to that, as did, I think, Schwarzkopf and a few other people, James Baker, the former Secretary of State. And, in fact, Scowcroft more recently pointed out that he thought that the elections would actually expose the contours of a civil war. And now we're beginning to, there's a report today in the Los Angeles Times saying that it looks like the civil war is breaking out. So,
well, let me interrupt you there, Ian. There's already a civil war in Iraq.
Right.
And it's just a matter of whether or not it's going to intensify and worsen and lead to the country's fragmentation, which won't be on sectarian lines, but on ethnic lines between Arabs and Kurds. So I wouldn't underestimate the severity of the problems that exist today in Iraq, and nothing that the Iraqis are confronting was unforeseeable. In fact, all of the constitutional and power-sharing issues that Iraqis have been debating now for the past several years were discussed at enormous length in the Future of Iraq project. So it should take no one by surprise that transforming Iraq into a democracy and achieving a power-sharing arrangement that keeps the country from falling apart is an extremely challenging and difficult task.
Well, it's as though George Bush's mistake has become all of our problem. I mean, when you talk about accountability, it's true that the president should be accountable for his mistakes, but I guess everybody feels that this is such a huge problem and a great sort of gaping wound that we have to try and fix it.
There are plenty of people who were against the war who would like to see the United States.
Hello, did we lose you? I'm afraid we just... Could you call David Phillips back, please? I'm speaking with David Phillips, who's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he's a former senior advisor to the State Department. He held... led the State Department's efforts, or as part of the State Department team that, as he mentioned, spent 2 years prior to the Iraq War planning for an occupation and reconstruction of Iraq, and all of their work was essentially shunted aside by the Pentagon and the results of this incredibly counterintuitive situation are manifestly apparent today. Are you back with me, David?
Yes, I am. Sorry about that.
So my question was, David, you can sort of excuse them to some extent, the Pentagon, for disregarding the civilian side of things and getting that wrong. But how could they have gotten the military side so wrong and not recognized that Saddam had been beaten once, he knew he was going to lose, that he prepared for a guerrilla war and pre-positioned material, and how could they have not seen this insurgency?
When General Jay Garner was given the lead role to the Office for Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, the military/civilian planning anticipated that Saddam would use WMD, that there would be oil well fires, and that Iraq's neighbors would send their armies across the border.
Obviously, none of that occurred. The most tragic decision that the Pentagon made was to ignore what's called Phase 4 stability operations. When the field commanders tore down the statue of Saddam Hussein in Tahrir Square on April 9, they had no instructions about buildings to secure and steps to take preventing chaos and looting. We always emphasize in our planning for the post-war the importance of demonstrating immediate and tangible progress. Having no phase four plan to stabilize the country was a remarkable decision based on ignorance and arrogance and incompetence.
And given that we see it all sort of blowing up in our face, I guess the most difficult question of all is what do you do now? I mean, what would your advice be?
You can't cut and run, because if Iraq would implode and a civil war erupts, it would be a disaster in humanitarian terms, with thousands of Iraqis killed, hundreds of thousands of refugees. So you need a plan to accelerate the political process and the training of Iraqi security services. The United States can't and should not do that alone. It should convene an international summit, establish a contact group for Iraq made of major donors, permanent members of the Security Council, and Iraq's frontline state. What's important is to not meddle in the internal affairs of Iraqi politics, because Iraqis will do the exact opposite of what we want them, and to internationalize the reconstruction and security training so that the Iraqis feel as though they're not alone and there's an international coalition which is legitimate and there to help them.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time, and I'd like to get a sense of whether there will be any reckoning for the neocons whose recklessly utopianism and sheer incompetence has put this country into its worst foreign policy disaster, perhaps in its recent history. I guess we can only hope that there's some justice in the world.
We can hope that there's justice in the world, but you know, there's something called regime change in the West, and that's two elections. And we have to recognize that officials that are elected have to be held accountable, and that the American public needs the truth and the facts in order to act upon its decisions that are well-informed.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, David Phillips.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with David Phillips, who's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and a former senior advisor to the State Department, where he's a part of the group that looked into post-war Iraqi construction. He's the author of a new book, Losing Iraq, Inside the Post-War Reconstruction Fiasco. I thank the engineer, Jazz Shepherd, Louis Vandenberg, the producer, and Carol Coote and Rusty Gwynn, the assistant producers. This program is available at ianmasters.org.